Curious about your fertility status? Start learning with home testing kits from Let's Get Checked. A kit gets sent discreetly to your place, you collect a quick sample, and send it back. With only a 2 to 5 day wait time, you receive your results really quick with an email notification when they are available on the website. I've done it myself with the female fertility test and found it really interesting to learn for myself. Now you can do it too with 20% off using code DNATODAY. Redeem your exclusive offer as a DNA Today listener by going to letsgetchecked.com and entering code DNA Today at checkout for that 20% discount.
How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.
Hello, you're listening to DNA Today, a genetics podcast and radio show. I'm your host, Kira Dineen. On this show, I explore genetics and how it impacts our health through conversations with leaders in genetics. These are genetic counselors, researchers, doctors, patient advocates, and more. This episode continues DNA Today's series about infertility. Over the last few episodes of DNA Today, we've talked with experts in fertility. On the first episode, we heard from Lauren Isley, a genetic counselor, about artificial reproductive technologies and the genetic counseling side. Following that, we had the Baileys on the show to share their reciprocal IVF journey in part one and part two. My guests today to continue this fertility series are documentarian Jacob Okada and anthropologist Carolina Taylor, who wrote and produced Anya, a fictional film about fertility, through their company First Encounter Productions. Carolina and Jacob are committed to creating complex characters and compelling stories informed by anthropology, science, and current events. Anya has had international screenings and was featured as a science and diversity film on Forbes. Thank you both so much for coming on the show. I'm really excited to talk about your film, and it was great to be able to meet you in person and be at a screening in Manhattan not long ago.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was great to meet you as well, and thanks so much for having us on DNA Today.
Yeah, and for those that are listening in Connecticut at UConn specifically, you may have already heard of their movie because you guys actually had a screening at UConn, which is how I found out about you guys. So it may sound familiar to some people, but we can jump into it. So can you give our audience a tease of what the film is about?
Sure. So Anya is a contemporary science fiction story. It's about a couple who are trying to have kids and running into a lot of problems. And they turn to a geneticist for help and find themselves in the middle of a major discovery that they then have to kind of deal with on the fly. And we bring in a lot of anthropology and genetics into the conversation.
And how did the project start? What inspired you to delve into a film with this focus of fertility and also the other topics that you just mentioned?
Well, we started writing Anya in 2014, I think, when I think the conversation started with kind of a what if question. And I think the question was, what if there were other species of humans living among us today? Right? More or less, Carolina?
Yes.
Okay. I'm trying to remember. Like, you know, we like to pose, you know, questions like just for the hell of it and, you know, what if questions, and then follow the chain of logic. And so, you know, the idea that, you know, there could be other species of humans living among us was kind of interesting because it made me wonder, well, how does one define a species? And then, you know, Carolina, being an anthropologist, has some background in teaching genetics, right?
A little bit.
So she was able to kind of provide like, you know, one definition. And then from there, we were like, well, that's interesting. How would we discover? How would people, scientists, make a discovery of like other species of humans living among us today? You know, fertility was like kind of the most obvious.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much infertility is unexplained, and we're gathering more and more data as people are trying to have kids and explore the reasons for their infertility. And I think as scientists start going through this growing database around fertility, they're going to start making some interesting discoveries. Maybe not that there's a second species of humans alive today, but that has happened in our past. So this story became a, what if it happened now? How would it be discovered through fertility? And what would it be like for the couple that finds themselves in the middle of this and for the scientist who is making the discovery?
Right. And so it was interesting to us to have to the idea that a couple, an infertile couple who, you know, who wants to conceive, you know, just and, you know, live their lives in this, like a normal couple would then have to deal with the fallout of being part of a scientific discovery that also has kind of, you know, implications on how we define ourselves, you know, like lots and lots of cultures have this idea of, well, a human's special place in the, you know, among all.
Yeah, a lot of the names for different cultures actually get translated to the people or the center of the earth. Like it's kind of inherent in how we think of ourselves, that, of this centrality of it. So what happens if you have another group out there who's different enough? Do we care? Do we turn to genetic technologies to overcome the difference?
Right.
And it's such an interesting concept to have this, oh, there's two species that you're thinking, oh, yeah, everybody's human in the movie. And what we're alluding to is that there is this, oh, some of these people are actually a different species. And that's where the infertility issues are coming into play. And, you know, at first people are like, oh, how can I relate to that of different species happening? But I mean, like out of 100 couples in the U.S., 12 to 13 of them have trouble becoming pregnant and have those fertility issues. So it's a cool combination of really that kind of maybe humanistic isn't the right word in this, but kind of humanistic perspective and those feelings along with really cool science. And I feel like that's what makes a good movie. Maybe just because I'm a huge nerd, but I think it really brings in both of those concepts. That's really cool. And a lot of people can relate to this.
Yeah, we're nerds too, like confirmed nerds as well.
Yeah, I think the three of us get the title. I think we've all achieved that by now.
And like, yeah, to us, it was like, honestly, this making the movie was just, on one level, it was just an excuse to geek out. Like, oh, let's learn about genetics. Let's, you know, we can write this movie and dig into research and learn about genetics, but also meet geneticists and talk to them and get even deeper into, you know, some cutting edge science. And that's what we ended up doing, in fact.
And the movie changed a lot because of that. I mean, part of what we're not saying is that when we started writing Anya in May 2014, we were also finishing the edit of another movie, which is a documentary about called Painting the Way to the Moon. And that movie's about a mathematician and artist who makes a major discovery. And it's kind of engaging the narrative that people tell about discoveries. So this idea of discovery was really kind of deep with us at the time. And we're also a couple. And we got married that month. And I remember part of our what the if question that day, that day of the what if a second species of human exists, part of the what if was, if I were a different species of humans, would you still marry me? And the answer was, yeah, of course. What difference is that? I mean, it's just fertility. And that's kind of where Libby and Marco and Seymour were born, was from that kind of question. And we were able to take, over the next couple months, we were able to use my anthropology and Jacob's documentary background to craft a basic story. But we really wanted real science for our scientists in the film to be discovering and to be investigating, to give it the verisimilitude And that's when we got in touch with the National Academy of Sciences Science and Entertainment Exchange. And through them, Dr. Ching Wu at Harvard Medical School, she's also works with a group called the Personal Genetics Education Project, PGED. And they're very, she and her group are very interested in educating the public about genetics through film and congressional briefings and all kinds of interesting avenues. And she and Ruth came on. Dr. Ruth McColl was a postdoc with her at the time and is now out in Seattle. And through our conversations with them, through hanging out with them in the lab and going to these briefings, the movie just started to grow and morph and start reflecting them more. Ruth wrote very short scenes for the film. They shaped how we portrayed not only science, but also our scientists. And it became more and more grounded in like cutting edge genetics and what was going on in the world.
I'm really impressed with just how accurate it was, because I didn't know you guys. I showed up to the film. I was like, okay, I hope this is good. I hope it's all accurate. And I was, very impressed that you had all of this in place to make sure it was. And there's so many times where I'm watching some show and they do something about genetics and, it's the pet peeves of mine that I'm like, oh, okay, that's not entirely accurate. Or like a lab person would never do that. And everything in the movie was like, wow, I can relate to that. Like I've done a little bit of lab so far, like not too much of a background, but even little things like, oh, you had a centrifuge, you had Kim wipes, parafilm, like the littlest bits that I'm like, wow, this is like the lab that I used to work in. So it was really exciting, and it felt very validating to have something be a very accurate representation, at least of my experience. Can't speak to everybody, but it was cool to be able to see that. Were you able to film it in an actual lab that was active, or was it a lab that wasn't being used? How did that work?
That was a real lab.
That's an active genetics lab.
Yeah.
So did you just say, oh, we're filming, you all have to leave?
No, the process was a little more complicated. We'd hoped to film at Harvard, but they got burned by a movie that came in and said they were one thing and then turned everything into a horror story. So they even let the Social Network film there. I mean, that was just a no-go, even though our scientists were very eager to have us film, and we had some like great interactive scenes planned and stuff. So that didn't happen. But Ruth put us in touch with a colleague of hers, Dr. Andreas Fenning, who's at Carnegie Mellon University. He's a computational biologist, a computational geneticist, I should say. And he was able to convince his filming office and his department that it was a good idea for us to come and film in his lab. And one of his postdocs was on hand with us the whole time, and she and Ruth acted as
on-set science advisors.
On-set science advisors, like teaching our actors how to pipette and how to use the very real centrifuge.
You made sure it was a balanced centrifuge when you were doing it and all of that.
Even the sequencing, so they don't have a sequencer in that lab. Had we filmed in Harvard, there would have been a sequencer in the same lab and we could have shot that. But they don't actually do that in this lab. They have to send out their samples to get them sequenced, and then they get thumb drives back with the data on it. So that's what Dr. Seymour Livingston, our fictional scientist, does in the film.
Yeah, he walks through the door and he's like, oh, that's the incoming data. He picks up the USB, walks off to his office. I was like, yeah, that's accurate. Because we can't all afford sequencers in our labs. That's like, you're lucky if you have one, if that's what your lab focuses on. But yeah.
Yeah, we definitely paid attention to all the details.
And Ruth also put us in touch with the University of California, Santa Cruz's genome browser group. So you see in the film, Seymour's interacting with a data analysis program that helps him visualize the DNA, and he sees kind of like the breaks in the husband's DNA compared to the wife and some other things like that. And that's actually a real program created by a real group out at UC Santa Cruz. And I had the pleasure of stopping by and showing them the film a couple weeks ago.
Wow, that's so cool. And when I was watching it, I was like, this looks really familiar. And now that you say that, I'm like, oh, I have used that before. You know, I'm not usually like doing things like that. I'm more talking about genetics than doing it. But yeah, it was cool to put that together. And it's just so interesting, even as an area in science people can go in, of being able to collaborate with films and other, you know, types of media to say, okay, I want to make sure this is accurate. I had a chance to do that for a novel that was like a genetics thriller novel called Biohack. And so it's just so cool that that is an area to go into, and so exciting that people are taking advantage of that and including the scientific community in what they're doing. I mean, it must have been really hard to keep up with all the genetic technology and news since, you know, we've said that you started like in 2014, but the movie came out in 2019. So was it difficult to keep up with it? Like, genetics changes every week.
I wouldn't say that it was so difficult to keep up with it, but as the news came to us, it did shape the story. So when we started writing, it was around the time that we were discovering major things about Neanderthal DNA within Homo sapiens sapiens DNA, and that we, like, people from Europe and Asia actually carry a percentage of their DNA inherited from Neanderthals. So that infused into the movie very early on because of that that news that was coming out. And then as we were working with Ruth and Ting, we were aware that they were part of conversations about whether or not germline gene editing should be possible. And we had conversations with George Church, who's one of the founders of CRISPR.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah, but we weren't out to make a movie about gene editing. We were just around it at a time when people knew that it was coming fast down the pipeline. So it ended up becoming part of the movie in, I think the scripts in 2016 had it. We filmed in 2017. So we were editing and putting the final touches on the music and the color correction and sound design whenever the news of the Chinese scientist who claims to have created the CRISPR twins came out. Like, we'd already filmed and we were editing when that happened.
No, the film was finished by that point. It was complete.
Wow, I'm surprised, because I could have swore the lead scientist in the movie said, like, referenced something about the CRISPR babies in China. And I was like, whoa, how did they do that? But it must have just been, like, the way it was written. And then it kind of, now it feels like it alludes to that. But maybe you were thinking of something else. Like, how does the dates work on that?
Well, I think what he said was,
it's only been done in China.
It's only been done in China, but it was, I think at that point when we had filmed, there was, maybe China hadn't signed onto the moratorium. Maybe that's what it was.
Right. I think they were doing more research with CRISPR than we had, or started clinical trials or something around that time. I could be wrong on that. That's just me guessing.
We knew that that was going to date the movie, but so we kept it vague enough that I think the inference that you made, like, it kind of turned out to be more true than we realized, you know?
Yeah, it was amazing. I was like, did they go back and film just that? But I was like, I was sitting there being distracted. I was like, okay, get back into the movie.
Yeah. It was all locked by then. And we also didn't mention CRISPR by name at any point, which is interesting because non-scientists think that's a mistake, and that we were being generic about it and we didn't know that it was on the horizon. We knew. We knew it was there, but we also knew that it wasn't the only technology that was going to be able to do gene editing.
Right, and we're already using other technology that clinical trials are using, like TALENs and things like that. So I feel like, yeah, that's a good move to keep it general, because there could be the next big thing in 6 months and you're like, wow, now the movie's outdated, where it's enough that you talk about the technologies and everything, but you still have a little bit of that mystery to it.
And I think one of the things we were interested in exploring was just the messiness of, like, a scientific discovery, like how things unfold in the movie is quite by accident. The scientist accidentally makes this discovery, and then you know, is trying to, you know, follow up on it, and it's ethically very difficult, you know, to handle, you know, on one hand, this scientist's real desire to collect the data and follow where the thread is, like pull on that thread, but then on the other hand, respect, you know, people's desire to have their kids and you know, and also have privacy. So
yeah, so something we haven't really said yet is that so this couple, Marco and Libby, Marco actually belongs to an enclave immigrant community in Queens. And so part of the movie is going into this community and trying to get samples, DNA samples, to determine if they all share the genetic variant that's keeping Marco from being able to have offspring with other Homo sapiens sapiens. And that piece of the film is seeming to resonate quite a lot with geneticists, genetic counselors especially. But in practice, it's actually coming a lot from my anthropology background, because, I mean, I go into communities and villages and throughout Latin America and the U.S., and we have to think about research ethics and how to include people and how to take into consideration their needs and their wants and their beliefs, and as much as possible allow that to drive the research. So a lot of the ethics that we were first considering in the film were around this researching with vulnerable populations, and we're discovering now in the sharing of the film that that actually resonates with people who are doing genetic testing research or who are doing research with vulnerable populations because of a certain disease or something. So it's been kind of a good coincidence in that regard. Or
yeah, I had those thoughts when watching, you know, those scenes, and especially this scene that we've kind of alluded to a little bit of when the scientist kind of speaking out loud of his ethical dilemma of, I want to do this, but I want to be able to respect you. And so all of the bioethics part of the movie, I'm going to be a genetic counselor in the near future. And I also identified with that of being able to really respect patients and where they're coming from. And also the disparity we have in genetic testing. Of most genetic testing research has been done on Caucasian people of European ancestry, and we don't have as much information or research on other ethnicities and populations. And so we have less to offer sometimes with genetic testing. Of the genetic testing isn't as in depth or cover as much information, just because if we find a difference in someone, if we find a variant, or some people say mutation, of if we find something, we may not be able to understand what it means as much as if we find something in someone of like a European ancestry, because we have more research on it. And so that's something that we really need to address in the community. And we're making a little progress, but it's a little bit. So it was interesting to see you really be able to address this in the film and kind of explore it a little bit more.
Yeah, we basically made the movie for people like you.
Yeah, I'm pretty much your target audience right here.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we found, I don't know, interesting was just this, the gap between the narval, like the general population, their knowledge, the knowledge gap between like the general population and then the scientists, and like we found it interesting just from a story point of view to put the scientist in this position of having to explain like really complex things to people who don't necessarily have a science background.
Which is my job, and it's very difficult.
Right.
And do it in a way that respects the listener. So it's something I run into sometimes with scientists in general, including social scientists, is that they, when they talk about trying to explain their work to other people, they the frustration that comes out is almost like talking down about the people that they're talking to. And I think something that we believe, and that Seymour, the geneticist in the film, believes, is that the person you're talking to, just because they don't have a science education, doesn't mean they're not intelligent and they can't get up to speed. But it's this—it's still a dance of trying to respect this person and their equalness in the conversation, and get to a point where you can have an in-depth conversation about ethics or medical procedures or whatever the next steps are. So that's something that was in the back of our minds too as we were working on the film.
Yeah,
and I think one way you've kind of flipped the script on that was how the wife in the movie, that's, you know, meeting people from her husband's ethnicity and everything, she starts learning about their culture. And so as the scientist comes in from, you know, our world, is teaching about that, then it's the reverse, that they're teaching kind of outsiders information about their culture and having that kind of two way. So it's not just giving information one way. And it was also so refreshing to see such a diverse cast. And you don't see a lot of scientists in movies and media that, you see a lot of white scientists. And so it was really refreshing to have a different perspective on that.
Yeah. I mean, we cast Seymour as a black man, and that was like a dramatic choice, you know, like a story choice, because like you said, you don't see that many black scientists, but also we know, you know, just from talking with our science advisors that there are very few black geneticists, and they're treated differently. And just knowing that, and knowing what a minority among scientists would go through, it was an interesting story choice, you know, to have Seymour have to explain to these people, Narwhal people in Queens, like, you know, from this kind of position of power, but also as a minority who, you know, who was aware, you know, of how African Americans were subject to experiments, you know, not that long ago. And so there's a mistrust among the black community, you know, for science and research, you know, because of, you know, these terrible experiments that were done on them. So we just thought that was an interesting dramatic choice, and it added a layer of complexity, you know, for our actor Motel Foster to deal with. And we didn't like, you know, it's not like we talked about it in the film or anything, but it was definitely a, you know, in the actual text, but it was part of the background.
Definitely. And having it just be normalized to like, don't need to address it. And that can be as powerful. Well, I think we've sold people on watching the movie if they haven't already. Where can people watch it?
The easiest is to go to anyamovie.com. So ANYAMOVIE.com/watch now. We are on pretty much all the on-demand platforms that you, including Apple, Amazon, Fandango Now, Google Play, Vimeo, Vudu, and Xbox, as well as DVD.
And I know you guys went to UConn and were able to talk with students there. If other university institutions, communities are interested in utilizing the movie somehow, what have you done in the past? What can you offer to either come on campus or Skype? I don't know what you usually do.
So we've done a range of things. We have hosted screenings. This is just partnering with an organization or a university that's interested in screening the film. We've done very small things in an individual classroom, in which case I've Skyped in and larger 300-person screenings with at UConn. We've also been at several UC schools. I'm going to Winston-Salem, North Carolina tomorrow for a screening in conjunction with the Science of Winston-Salem and Wake Forest University. And it's basically a matter of emailing us. You can do that through anyamovie.com, letting us know what you have in mind, and we can work out an arrangement. That's basically it.
And any other upcoming projects, or really focus on distributing Anya and having people enjoy that?
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, yeah, at this point, so we just released the film like last week, Anya. So we're just kind of having fun promoting it, and
we both have projects on the back burner that we're looking forward to coming to working on again soon. We have a project on gentrification these are both at the script stage, and one on immigration that's based on my research in Honduras.
Wow, very interesting. We'll have to keep our eye on those projects. Thank you so much for coming on the show and being able to just discuss all of these topics of bioethics and genetics and diversity. I mean, we covered a lot of different things today on the episode, but there's just so much more that you explore in the movie, and it was just so well done. And I left the theater like, wow, that was a really, really great film, and definitely great for all you genetic nerds listening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So much fun.
If you really would like to watch the movie Anya, go to anyamovie.com. That's A-N-Y-A movie.com/watch now. And if you really enjoyed this episode, I would suggest going back and listening to episode 84 of DNA Today. I talk with the author, J.D. Lassica. He's the author of Biohack. And we worked together on marketing this book when it came out, and the sequel has now also been released. And we had a really interesting bioethical conversation about CRISPR. So very similar to this episode in terms of talking about fictional and how that impacts today's world and the science we have going on, that genetic editing. So I think you would really enjoy that episode as well. So I'll give you a recommendation on episode 84. And that's on dnapodcast.com, where all the episodes of this show are. But you can also find it on Spotify, Apple, Overcast, so many different podcast apps. All you have to do is search DNA Today. Pops right up. If you are on Twitter, follow me, please, at DNA Podcast. If you're on Instagram, at DNA Radio, would love to connect with you on there. It's great to be able to interact with listeners, because usually I'm doing the show one way and I don't get to interact too much. So it's great to interact on there. And another way to interact is by emailing at info@dnapodcast.com. Any questions you have for guests that I have on, like today's episode, or you have an idea for the show, or you just want to say thanks for doing the show, enjoy it, would love to hear from you. Email in info@dnapodcast.com. Let's Get Checked has stepped up during this pandemic, and I want to thank them for their new two-part test for COVID-19 right now for healthcare workers. They committed to 250,000 tests in the first batch, with the goal to scale to serve over 1 million in the next few months. As most of you know, Let's Get Checked is sponsoring the series with their at-home testing kits. They have a bunch of fertility tests if you're curious about your fertility status. As I mentioned before, the kit gets sent right to your house, and the sample's a blood sample, but it's from a fingerprint, so you can do it right at home. No need to go into Quest and have your blood drawn. Then you receive your results in just 2 to 5 days, which in my experience is much quicker than most home testing kits, where it's like a couple weeks. A couple of hormones that are looked at in their CLIA-certified lab for the female fertility tests includes follicle-stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone. I found the report on the website super easy to read, but there's also physicians and nurses that you can talk to if you're confused at all in reading this report and understanding really what it means. Try for yourself by going to letsgetchecked.com and use code DNATODAY for 20% off your kits. Again, you can use code DNA Today for that 20% discount on your kits at letsgetchecked.com. Thanks for listening, and join me next time to learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.